Hey there, listeners. I'm Evan McCormick, and welcome to the official premiere episode of my show on WGXC, Music in Time. You might have heard my pilot episode last month on Audio Buffet, but this here is my official time slot and my official debut, the fourth Wednesday of every month at 10 a.m., Music in Time. Now, what's a show all about? Well, first, a bit about me. By day, I'm a historian at Columbia University. I spend my time thinking and writing about the mechanics behind historical events, turning points in the history of the United States and the world. Basically, I try to understand why things have turned out the way they have. But I'll be honest, any free moment in the day, I'm thinking about listening to or playing music. So, history and music. This show is my attempt to bring together those two worlds. Hence, Music in Time. Here's the big idea. Each episode, I'll take one album and highlight the historical moment in which it was released. Now, that could take different forms. Some weeks, we'll look at music that coincided with big historical events. Other weeks, we'll look at paradigm shifts in the way people made, recorded, or consumed music. I'll narrate a bit of the history, play you some songs, maybe bring in some outside voices. The idea here is that part of what gives music its meaning is the specific moment in which people connect to it. Individual listeners like you, but also listeners in the plural, groups of people, social movements, political movements, for whom music can serve as a collective language, a glue. So how do people connect with music in its moment? And how are historical shifts or turning points captured in what we listen to and when we listen to it? What shapes the way that an album gets remembered? What are the moments in which it becomes relevant again? Those are just a few of the themes that we'll be exploring each month on this show. And this week, I'll be taking you with me to the hills of Los Angeles in the early months of 1969 when the city was beset by a series of ecological crises, and a little-known band by the name of the Flying Burrito Brothers put out their debut album, The Gilded Palace of Sin. Welcome to Episode 2 of Music in Time. So this episode feels a little personal. You see, just last week I was in Los Angeles, and I spent some time in the Hollywood Hills, those rolling dry hills accentuated by those lush canyons. And at night, as the sun went down, at golden hour, I swear I could almost hear the Flying Burrito Brothers music floating in between the eucalyptus trees, wafting in from the San Fernando Valley. Maybe that's not the time and place in Los Angeles that you would pick. Maybe in your mind, you're in Laurel Canyon in 1966 at a party with Mama Cass and the Beach Boys. Maybe you're on the Sunset Strip in the 1980s. But for me, the sound and place is 1969. It was February 1969 when the Flying Burrito Brothers' debut, Gilded Palace of Sin, came out on A&M Records. The band was like something out of time, made up by two former members of the Byrds, Graham Parsons and Chris Hillman, along with Chris Etheridge playing bass and keyboards, pedal steel guitarist Sneaky Pete Kleino, and session drummer Fast Eddie Ho. In 1968, the band had taken up residence in a house in the San Fernando Valley, a few miles north of where I was in the Hollywood Hills, in a house that came to be known as Burrito Manor, where they wrote most of their songs, recording them for the Gilded Palace of Sin later that year. It's a collection of beautiful country tunes laden with lovelorn sadness, some sense of humor, and Graham Parsons' beautiful voice. They had a sense of just being a little off on their own. Now, the cover of the album famously features the band in what would become their trademark rhinestone-covered nudie suits, off in some California scrubland with a small whorehouse, it looks like, behind them, titled The Gilded Palace of Sin. And if I had been there in 1969, I would have been thinking about oil. Wait, oil? Yes, oil. Just a week before this album came out, just up the coast from Los Angeles, in Santa Barbara, California, 6 miles off the coast, a Union oil tanker had suffered a blowout, spewing thousands of gallons of oil each hour into the ocean. It ravaged wildlife, killing birds by the hundreds. The oil started to accumulate on the beaches, up to an inch thick in some places. Strong winds started to push the slick further south, closer to Los Angeles, with oil coming ashore in Santa Monica and being spotted off Malibu. For days, the front page of the New York Times featured coverage of the spill, the desperate attempts to cap it, and tracking the environmental damage. On February 6th, the cover featured a cormorant covered in oil. Bird was beyond saving, the text below the picture read. It was on that day, February 6th, that the Gilded Palace of Sin hit record store shelves. And that's what would have been on my mind when I set the needle down and heard the opening chords of the opening track, Christine's Tune. That was Christine's Tune, the opening track off the Flying Burrito Brothers' The Gilded Palace of Sin, released in February 1969 just as the Santa Barbara oil spill was spewing into the Pacific Ocean and, many feared, drifting southward towards Los Angeles. By the time Union Oil managed to cap the leak, almost 3 million gallons had escaped into the ocean, with the slick ranging over 35 miles from the rig. The spill remains the third largest oil spill in U.S. history, even 50 years later. The response to the crisis was as swift and as massive as the spill itself. It started on the local level, with a group called Get Out Oil, goo, get it, founded in Santa Barbara within the day after the spill. The group aimed to build public opposition to stop companies from drilling in the Santa Barbara Channel. It later became clear that Union Oil had skirted some of the normal safety precautions for drilling on the ocean floor. In addition to local outrage, the spill also garnered massive national attention, one of the first ecological disasters to be broadcast to TV screens across the country. Spurred on by the attention, President Richard Nixon visited the oil spill. Remember, Nixon was from Yorba Linda, California, just south of Los Angeles, and his Western White House was in San Clemente, beachfront property in California. Now, there's a great picture of Nixon, surrounded by a gaggle of suit-wearing reporters, business suits, not nudie suits, surveying the damage. Afterwards, Nixon famously said, quote, "The Santa Barbara incident has frankly touched the conscience of the American people." Now, in an oral history of the spill done recently by Pacific Standard magazine, the organizers of GOO remember that Nixon was there for about 10 minutes. Afterwards, those members drove down to San Clemente, tried to deliver petitions holding over 200,000 signatures to Nixon personally. Unsurprisingly, Secret Service wouldn't let them do so. A joint lawsuit by the city, county, and state against Union Oil dragged on for years until it was settled in 1974 for more than $9 million. Now, I want to get something out of the way. I am not claiming that The Gilded Palace of Sin is an environmentalist album. I'm not claiming that Graham Parsons was trying to start or connect with an environmentalist movement. That's not exactly what this show is about. This show is about understanding how listeners connected with music in its time. And that's what I love about this album. These aren't high-minded songs of social commentary. This is a collection of tunes that you could expect to hear on the jukebox in an out-of-the-way dive bar in the San Fernando Valley. In fact, that's where Graham Parsons preferred to play them. And yet, even here, the sense creeps in that something's off. The world has been thrown askew. The environment needs to be put right. And that's on full display in track two of this album, Sin City, a song that plays with traditional country music themes of religious reckoning, but a reckoning reserved specifically for the excesses of Los Angeles. And it's here in the refrain when Parsons sings, "That old earthquake's gonna leave me in the poorhouse. I feel like this whole town's insane." Together with the image in the chorus of the Lord's burning rain, that really feels like it connects with that moment of environmental disaster in 1969, as oil was lapping at California's beautiful shores, whether you were in the dunes of Malibu or at a dive bar in the San Fernando Valley.
Take it home, right away. You got
What a song. You're listening to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm Evan McCormick. This is a show where we put albums in their historical moment. That line in that song, "A friend came around and tried to clean up this town," is believed to be a reference to Robert F. Kennedy, who had been shot and killed at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles in June of 1968, about 7 months before this album came out. But we're talking today about the context of environmental crises. And you know, it wasn't only an oil spill that was besieging the City of Angels at the beginning of 1969. There was something else, an old nemesis, smog. Los Angeles had been dealing with smog for decades, smog being a phenomenon caused by sunlight hitting nitrogen oxides in the atmosphere, particles produced by, among other things, the pollution caused by power plants, factories, and automobiles. It was made much worse in Los Angeles by the geography of the city, basically in a basin which traps the ozone that this reaction creates. You've probably seen photos, maybe you've even experienced it yourself. There are some wild photos from the 40s, 50s, and 60s of Angelenos wearing gas masks as they deal with the effects of smog. So smog was nothing new. But what had changed by the late 1960s was that the state and the people of Los Angeles were dead set on doing something about it. In 1968, the state formed the California Air Resources Board, elevating pollution control to the state cabinet level. The first chair of CARB was Dr. Arjan Hagen-Smit, a scientist from the California Institute of Technology who is credited with first linking smog to automobiles. And that's where California was trying to make a dent in smog in 1969, calling for tougher regulations on automobiles, requiring that new cars be fitted with exhaust control devices like catalytic converters. The trouble was that without federal support, the state could only bring so much pressure to bear on the auto industry, which was resisting regulation. That started to change in the late 1960s, as a broader awareness of the effects of smog gained steam around the country. And around the time that the album came out, in 1969, a series of national hearings were directing attention to the role of auto pollution in the smog crisis. And images of Los Angeles played a huge role in the way Americans envisioned the effects of smog. At the end of 1970, Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act, which federalized regulations and led to tougher controls on hydrocarbons and exhaust coming from cars. Of course, the smog problem never really went away. I could still see it there in Los Angeles last week, in part because the number of cars just continued to proliferate. That's true everywhere in America, but in LA especially, a city you have to drive to get around. That was something that Graham Parsons knew well. He once said that the thing he loved most about the city were the honky-tonks in the valley. On the other hand, he said, quote, "The most negative thing I can think of is the strip itself, with all those people addicted to carbon monoxide." And after all, who knew more about America's love affair with the automobile than a good country musician like Graham Parsons? Some of his own best songs are about driving anyway. Here's Wheels from the Gilded Palace of Sin.
We've all got wheels to take ourselves away. We got telephones to say what we can't say. We've all got higher and higher every day.
We tend to think of 1968 as the convulsive year in American political history. The assassinations of RFK and Martin Luther King Jr., the Vietnam War, protests against the war. And you can start to see how this environmental awareness the year after, the sense of the Earth's vulnerability, but also anger at corporate malfeasance and at the government's inability to protect the environment, started to change traditional ideas about conserving the environment into activism to protect it, that was part of the same counterculture. Now, I've said before, I don't really think this is an activist album, but there is something interesting in the way Graham Parsons' take on country music questions that status quo. I found this great quote from Graham Parsons, who wasn't the most outspoken of figures, in an interview around the time of the album release. He said, quote, "The Vietnam War signaled the beginning of psychedelica explosions in music, and now as the war seems to be violently exhausting itself, there's a return to the quiet, the simple, the roots of a nation." Maybe there's a clue in there to thinking about early 1969 and the cosmic country California that this album helped create. It was only 7 years earlier that Rachel Carson's Silent Spring had been released, a groundbreaking book about the harm caused by the widespread use of synthetic pesticides, a book which sparked a mass awareness of environmental harm in the United States. Now here in 1969, there was something else growing on, a widening sense that man-made technology and industry, modern ways of living, were harming the world. Now, many historians actually consider the Santa Barbara oil spill to be the beginning of the environmental movement. The National Environmental Policy Act, the NEPA, was being drafted when the Union oil tanker blew. Additional disasters that year, like the famous fire on the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, helped propel that legislation, which would create the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970. The local activists in Santa Barbara who had formed GOO sought to parlay local outrage over the oil spill into a broader popular movement for environmental protection. Their activism helped create, among other things, the first environmental studies program at UC Santa Barbara. But nationally, it wasn't just laws and policies. Environmentalism was becoming a thing in 1969 and 1970. Famously, the first Earth Day was celebrated on April 22, 1970. Inspired, its creator, Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, said, by what had happened in Southern California the year before. Now, as I said before, I don't think, and I wouldn't argue, that the Flying Burrito Brothers were part of that movement, or the Gilded Palace of Sin is part of that movement. But if you put yourself back in 1969, and you listen to the album in that frame, you can hear those tinges of awareness in the music of the Earth's being vulnerable. You can start to see how music could be one way of expressing that sense of vulnerability, that need to protect the environment. And I would argue that the image of California, and Los Angeles in particular, was always central to that, especially in song. Songs like the one I'm about to play now, which so perfectly captured the desire and the need to protect the environment as the movement began to grow. Here's Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi, released the same month as the first Earth Day celebration in April of 1970 on her album, Ladies of the Canyon.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
I'm Evan McCormick, and you're listening to Music in Time, the show that puts albums in their historical moment. And we started this episode talking about The Gilded Palace of Sin by the Flying Burrito Brothers and the way it was framed by ecological crises in Los Angeles in 1969. One thing I like to do every episode is ask, what are some other moments when similar themes might have been framing the way that people engage with music, particularly the theme of ecological disaster? Well, after the 1960s, that question becomes a lot more interesting, given that there now is an environmental movement to speak of, a mass cultural awareness of the risks that technology and industry pose to the environment. On March 28, 1979, a nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania suffered a partial meltdown, releasing radioactive gases and iodine into the atmosphere. It remains the worst nuclear accident in American history, and at the time, it focused public fears on the dangers of unregulated nuclear power for communities and the environment. Thinking about that moment, I couldn't help but have my mind go to a band that was famous for performing in radiation suits, Devo. Here's Wiggly World from their album Duty Now for the Future, released 3 months after the meltdown at Three Mile Island.
Now we
You're listening to Music in Time on WGXC. That was Wiggly World by Devo from 1979, followed by Dead Set on Destruction by Husker Du from their album Candy Apple Gray, which came out in March of 1986, just a month before the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in the former Soviet Union. Now, remember, I'm not trying to play movement music here. There's a whole genre of protest songs relating to the environment. But what I want to find is that music that's framed by an awareness of the need to protect the environment that's brought on by disasters and crises. And what's so interesting is as you trace this thread through time, starting in the 1960s, concurrent with the growing environmental movement, you find that those lines get blurred, that awareness of the environment is more pervasive. So for these next two songs, we're coming back to the theme of oil and water, and the year 1989 and the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The first song actually starts at a local level. It's 10,000 Maniacs, Poison in the Well from Blind Man's Zoo. This album came out just 2 months after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, but it actually looks back to a disaster much closer to home, the Love Canal tragedy in Niagara Falls, New York, in which the dumping of chemicals by Hooker Chemical Company in the 1940s led to widespread public health problems in the 70s and 80s, a tragedy that eventually led to the creation of the EPA's Superfund law. And after that, we've got the Sugar Cubes with Day Called Zero from the album Here Today, Tomorrow, Next Week, which came out later in 1989, but seems to wrap all of that environmental anxiety into a typically Bjorkian take on the end of the world.
All the names.
of course, there are important historical moments of ecological crisis and disaster that we couldn't get to in this episode. And I have to admit, I'm curious what listeners think of when they think of moments when music may have been framed by a sense of precarity in the environment around them. Maybe it was a natural disaster, something like Hurricane Katrina in 2005, in which music was so important to the recovery of New Orleans afterwards. Or maybe it's the BP oil spill of 2010 or the nuclear disaster at Fukushima in 2011. But as we fast forward more than 50 years from where we started the episode in Los Angeles of 1969, I wanted to point out that in a lot of recent music, the environmental crisis of our time, climate change, seems to be ever more present. In effect, you don't have to look so hard to find themes of environmental precarity, perhaps because there are reminders of it all around us. And I'm going to play two songs from recent years in which that fear of climate change seems to seep insidiously in. The first is Childish Gambino's 2018 Feels Like Summer. The second is Wise Bloods' A Lot's Gonna Change from her 2019 album Titanic Rising.
I feel like summer. Seven days. If I could go back to a time before now, before I ever fell down, go back to a time when I was just a girl, when I had
I'm tempted to tell you that the Los Angeles of 1969 looks a lot different than the Los Angeles of today. And it's worth mentioning that Gram Parsons wouldn't live to see so many of those changes, having tragically died of a drug overdose in 1973 in Joshua Tree. But as I listen to the Gilded Palace of Sin and think about oil spills and smog in 1969, and then I think about the danger posed to the environment by the excesses of our own time, I wonder if it's maybe not that different after all. And so long as we feel that urgency to protect the earth, good music should reflect it, hopefully more so than doom. On that note, I couldn't resist playing this one, which comes back to where it all started with Gram Parsons in Sin City with an earthquake.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane, and Lenny Bruce is not a Fury's breathing down your neck.
more slice and burn, return. Listen to yourself churn. Locking in, uniform and book burning, blood letting. Every motive escalate, automotive centerate. Light a candle, light a motive, step down, step down. Watch it heal, crush, crush, up. Oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear. A tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine. I feel fine. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
The other night I tripped an ice continental, drifted by a mountain, sit in a line, Leonard Bernstein, Leonid Brezhnev, Lenny Bruce and Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean.
It's not the end of the world, but it is the end of this episode, the second episode of Music in Time and the premiere episode at my normal time slot, the fourth Wednesday of the month at 10 a.m. I'm Evan McCormick, and I can't wait to join you this time again next month when we'll travel again. To when and where? Stay tuned, check me out on social media, and find out. I can't wait.